You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. This month we have a local author special. I'm joined by Jill Thompson, whose book The Oceans Between Us tracks child migrants who were moved from London to Australia over 50 years ago. Heidi James, whose forthcoming book, The Sound Mirror, traces the legacy of trauma, colonialism and displacement over three generations of women. Nick Rainstrick, whose book, The Bicycle Clip Diaries, is based on the real-life discovery of an envelope addressed to him from his late grandfather. Sharon Duggle, whose new book, Should We Fall Behind, addresses loss, devotion, displacement and tragedy, while Mark Radcliffe reads from his collection of short stories, Superpowers, which was sparked by the death of his beloved mother, his very own superhero. Our book club book this month is Rainbow Milk by Paul Mendes, which is published by Dialogue Books. The Brighton Book Club is also available as a podcast, which you can download from wherever you get yours. Just search for the Brighton Book Club. You can contact me on Twitter at Anna M. Burt, B-U-R-T-T. We're on Instagram at BTN Book Club, and you can email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. Hope you guys enjoy today's show. Jill Thompson, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Please, can you introduce yourself to me and the listeners?
Yes, I will. Hi, Anna. Thank you for inviting me. It's really good to be here. So, yeah, my name's Jill Thompson. Most of my life I've been a teacher, and very late on, by most people's standards, I had a second career as a writer, which took me by surprise, but it's just been absolutely amazing, and I feel a whole new lease of life. So I still do my teaching. I teach 2 days a week at a local college, but I also write, so I consider myself very, very lucky, and it really is a very, very long dream come true, and I'm finally there.
So The Oceans Between Us, your first book, was inspired by the true events where thousands of British children were shipped to Australia after World War II. When did you find the inspiration for this story, and what's the journey that led you to write it and have it published?
Yes, I mean, I think I've been subconsciously looking for a novel topic for years and years, and nothing had really presented itself. And it was just a random day, really. It was a February, it was 2009, and I was in the kitchen doing something very boring, listening to the lunchtime news, and I heard Gordon Brown, who was Prime Minister at the time, apologise to these ex-child migrants who'd been sent across from England to Australia, really in the sort of mid to late decades of the 20th century. And I was just horrified because many of them were lied to and told that their parents were dead. In fact, they were still alive. It was a pact between the two governments to repopulate Australia or boost the white population of Australia, rid the Brits of their overflowing children's homes. And so this sort of venture started. So I think my first reaction was utter horror, incredulity. I'd never heard of this before. And then a little kind of voice in my head saying, I've never read a book about this. I wonder whether this is the subject of my novel. So I started to research. I managed to get in touch with some ex-child migrants. I tracked down a nanny who went on board the first ship out after the war, phoned her up in Australia. She's now 96, and she sent an email the other week. She's in Melbourne. And started to piece together the story, and gradually the narrative emerged. I wanted to do it justice, obviously, because I wanted to be published, but also because these people, these are people's stories, these are people's lives, and I didn't feel I could do it anything but the very, very best job I could. And I did also ask their permission, because it wasn't my story to tell, but many of them said, We can't do this ourselves. Do it for us. So I then did a master's in creative writing, which was brilliant, at Chichester. And slowly, the novel came together. I was still teaching and all the other things, but it did take about 9 years to get from that very first idea, 10 years actually, until it was finally printed. But I was very lucky to get an agent, and she secured me a deal with Headline, who published it. So that's the story in brief, yes.
Can you read us a little bit from the prologue, please?
Yes, I certainly can. So I'll just read the first page. Even after all these years, he still dreads plane journeys. The takeoff is the worst, the rush of tyres on concrete, the scream of engines, a crescendo of pressure in his ears. There's a light touch on his hand. He looks down, her fingers on his white knuckles. All right, she says. He nods, then looks out of the window. The plane is climbing steeply, the runway already a biscuit-coloured blur. The landing gear folds itself in with a distant thump, and the engine steadies to a throb. He wipes his forehead with the back of his sleeve and leans his head against the rest. She squeezes his hand. Well done, you'll be fine now. Yes, he will be fine. He always is. But this time there is another anxiety. Not the journey, but the destination. He pats his jacket pocket and feels the firmness of the expensive cardboard against the warm wool. No need to take the invitation out again. He knows the words off by heart. And suddenly he's a young boy once more, excited to be going on a long journey to a land full of hope and opportunity. How was his eager 12-year-old self to know what was really waiting for him?
Oh, it's so intriguing.
And it hooked you.
It absolutely hit me. What has the response been to the books, and why do you think people are enjoying it?
Oh, it's been overwhelming, Anna, because as I say, it's not, it is a commercial venture, of course, it's a published book, but it's so much more than that. And it's put me in touch with so many ex-child migrants. And, you know, people have written, I think what's amazed me is so many people don't know this story. It's still not generally known in Australia or in England or in the States, where it seems to be going down very well. So lots of people have written to say, you know, thank you for telling the story and how awful it's not an entertaining read and sort of laugh out loud, but it's a kind of it does put people in touch with these events that really did happen. So I think if I can do my bit to raise awareness, then it's a job well done. Anything else is a bonus. Yeah,
absolutely. So your third novel, which you're working on now, does it have a name yet?
No, it might have something to do with lighthouse, but we're still sort of pushing the idea around because it's set by the sea. So I've always loved the sea, and I'm just trying to visit as many different seaside resorts just to stare at the waves and get some inspiration and see it in different moods. So
and has Brighton inspired you, Jill?
It has, yes. I love Brighton, and it's probably our nearest seaside town. So I have been down there, and just drinking it in, really, the sounds of the seagulls and the smell of the salt and the seaweed and all the rest of it. It's all kind of grist to the mill. So just taking lots of notes and lots of pictures.
Lovely. Jill, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. How can we find and follow you, and where can we buy a copy of your books?
Right, you can get a copy from the independent bookshops. You can go to the dreaded A site as well. it's very widely available. You also can follow me. I run a creative writing website, which may be of interest to some of your listeners. So what I try to do is not kind of preach about my own writing, but take inspiration from other writers and write down the kinds of things I've learned from them. And the site is www.wordkindling, that's all one word, wordkindling.co.uk, and I'm on Twitter at wordkindling as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Heidi James, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Congratulations on The Sound Mirror. It's an absolute masterpiece.
Oh, Anna, thank you. Thanks so much for having me on. And that's a beautiful thing to say. Thank you.
So it's been getting some really good early reviews, right? The reaction has been really strong so far. What do you think it is about this book that's really capturing people?
It has. And I just get so overwhelmed and you want to have a little cry. Which is getting a bit boring because my nose is really red and swollen. I think because they are flawed, but I'm trying to be very sympathetic and show how important relationships are, friendships, it's not just the family. But it isn't twee or saccharine. I'm not soft soaping anything. I think that's what seems to be resonating with people, that we can see some of ourselves reflected, but also understand how others feel. And I think that's what literature's gift is, that it's sort of a mirror and a window. And I'm not trying to beat anyone up, but by the same token, as I say, I'm not sort of pulling my punches. I think there's a way of interrogating and paying attention to others that is kind and honest, and I think that's what it seems to be resonating with people.
Absolutely. So if I were to say, what is The Sound Mirror about to anyone that hasn't seen it already yet, what would you say?
I would say it's about three generations of women who are interconnected. They are family eventually, but it's how the grandmothers grow and how the 20th century and all of its politics, the war, the traumas, colonialism, class, race, you know, all these things that we are in, the superstructure, impose themselves on us, in particular on women at that time who had very little agency, and how that impacts on them and how those resonances continue and echo through the generations, and how all those things intersect, really.
So there are three narrators in the book. So we've got Claire, Tamara and Ada. What made you decide, were you always going to tell it through three points of view? Like, how did you come to do that? And did you write them all separately and then put them together? Or did you write chronologically?
That's a good question, because that was my stumbling block. You know, you have like an idea for a story, and you know the characters are working, you know you've got what you need, but it's, for me, it's always perspective. Who's going to tell this story and how they're going to tell it? That's always the thing that sort of holds me at the starting gate, if you like. And then once I figured that out, off I go. At first, it was four women. I had the mother. So it's the two grandmas and their granddaughter who we hear. And at first, I had the mother in two. But what happened then was we had almost too much of the stories, and there was not enough gaps for the reader to sort of insert themselves, I think. And also the mother began to almost describe herself, defend herself, and it was too much, it was too heavy. So I pulled her out and it seemed to come alive. And then what I decided to do was tell them all in the present tense, it's not the sort of continuous present, but in the present. So we're, time is continually overlapping, so we're never in the past, its past is always with us, so that it sort of inhabits that trauma idea. But also, Tamara is told by her ancestors, it's almost this omniscient narrator, it's almost like her mitochondrial DNA, all the mothers, all the women inside her are telling her story, kind of thing. And the others are, yeah, sort of close third. And I really needed to get their voices tight and close to them, so that was quite tough. But yeah, once I figured that out, it wrote itself, really. And I wrote them separately, but I tried to do the chronological, and that was, honestly, I felt like I was losing my marbles a little bit trying to get these different voices. So I just thought, don't be silly. I just wrote Claire, and I was in her head and her voice, and then I wrote Ada, and then Tamara.
Claire and Ada are both displaced at the beginning of this book. Claire is Claire's exiled during the war as a child, and Ada leaves India. Yeah. And how did you kind of navigate the sense of displacement, and how did you personally feel that affected Tamara, who's the kind of protagonist of this book?
It felt like to have them both start at that point where they are being, as you say, displaced, either evacuated or, well, so they're both evacuated in a way, made sense. And it also, I think, I mean, it sounds really novelistic and horribly contrived, but I do think that was almost like the trigger point, the kickoff point for both of their traumas in a way. I mean, I'm sure we could look into other things, but I do believe for both those characters, that was the moment when everything began to unravel and then re-knot differently for them. And certainly for the Tamara character, she doesn't belong. And that sense of not really belonging and having this dreadful sense of shame comes from those women being moved and almost abandoned, if you like. Certainly for Claire, she felt very abandoned and not having a space to call their own. I think it's really important for all of us to feel like we're accepted and we belong, for every single one of us. I think it's pretty fundamental to our well-being, to know that we're okay where we are. And so that, I think that is the thing, that there are other things that have unsettled Tamara, that she has never truly belonged anywhere. So there's no refuge, there's no safety.
Absolutely. And not that safety in family that people find too, which is something that you explore really beautifully. Heidi, can you read us, please, the first section of the book?
I would absolutely love to. She is going to kill her mother today. But she's no monster. She's not the villain. It's a beautiful day for it, winter sharp, the sky an unfussy blue. She's taken 2 days holiday from work and hired a fancy car, a Mercedes, essential for this journey, where appearances and a quick getaway are everything. The man gave her a discount when she told him where she was going. The 200-mile round trip will be a breeze. She's dressed carefully too, just jeans and a shirt, but they're expensive, well cut, understated, but a signal to those in the know. So here we are, driving down to be face to face with her for the last time. And of course, we're along for the ride. How could we not? It's been a long time coming, and our fault, we should say. Funny that, speaking with one voice now, agreeing with each other. But yes, our fault, and all the others, tangled up with poisons and infections and rottenness. Our mothers and mothers' mothers containing us, we, in their bellies, seeds of each in the cells and the breath before the splitting in two, the doubling like an atomic bomb. So now she holds us all, a rabble of ancestors pressing up from inside against her skin. And she contains the next generation too, if she wanted, if she can bear to, bear it, bear a child. Who can blame her if not? But for now, she's the sum of all us women, the total. She is what's left. You imagine history trails you clanging like tin cans on a wedding car, but you're wrong. History is a halter that leads. We're beasts of burden with a ring through our nose. You go where we lead. We are not whole. We are fragments, ununified, unstable entities colliding under the swirling universe. Overflowing memories and feelings that are not our own. Archives of those who came before. It's almost romantic imagining we're individuals cut off from the rest, making ourselves feel special. What we are is the story she is made of. Then, of course, there's free will, if you believe in that, which she does. It's a nice idea, anyway, that we are free to choose our actions and the consequences. Passive, she drifts where she's pushed, lifted and dropped, caught in tides she can't fathom, impulses and currents she can't navigate.
Oh, it's such a delicious opening to a book, Heidi. It's so compelling. While you were reading that, I was thinking about the whole kind of free will versus determinism debate and how much of that, how much time you must have had to spend with that whilst researching and writing this book. Can you talk a bit, little bit about that?
Yeah, it fascinates me as well. I think what's really interesting is we can't get too far into that debate, because if we do, we've got to rethink all of our systems and structures. How do we punish people? How does the judicial system work if we acknowledge that we are not always in control of ourselves, of our impulses, that we are animals? I mean, it's almost that, I think. It's like we don't like to acknowledge that we are these mammals whose brains are mysterious, and that so much of our behavior is about hormones, chemicals, imbalances. I mean, you just have to be often I think as adults, we forget what it was like to be a teenager when you are completely out of control of your feelings and your thoughts. Do you know what I mean? Like, I remember sitting weeping and my mum saying, what's the matter? She's like, I don't know, nothing. You know, so much of us is about how we, the very world we're embedded in, the people, the structures. We are not what we think we are.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I still do that on a monthly basis, but that's a different episode. The Sound Mirror was published by Blue Moose Books, who are based up north, aren't they? And Blue Moose are a wonderful publisher. And this year are, if I'm right, only publishing books by women over 40, which is a very refreshing incentive. How do you feel to be involved with a company that is like making waves to really diversify who they're publishing?
I think it's fantastic. I'm really excited about it. They are always focusing on just great stories and being open to everyone. They saw, Kev, the publisher, and the editors saw an article about how women were being asked to change their names. They could be relaunched as a debut author if they were over a certain age, and also sort of hiding their age. And someone said something to me about, oh, women of a certain age. And I was like, I am 46 years old. I was an absolute caner. I'm delighted to still be here. I don't care. And this idea about hiding your age or pretending you're something you're not only reifies the fact that it's a shameful thing. And it bloody well isn't. Do you know what I mean? It's like, so I think it's great that we're celebrating it and saying that people have something to say. People have stories to tell. All of us have stories to tell. And it shouldn't be limited to who can tell them.
Yeah, couldn't agree anymore. It's
How would you say you feel about being a writer in Brighton? Like, have you been a writer in other places? And what do you feel is the difference between, you know, being a writer elsewhere and in Brighton?
I love being here. I love Sussex. I've always had a bit of a thing for Sussex. And I grew up in Kent and then lived in London, you know, very close by. You'd think there would be much of a difference, but I really feel there is. I feel there's something ancient and prime is not the right word. What I want is, there's something mythic about Sussex. I don't know if you feel that. I love being by the sea. I need to be by water. Even when I was in London, I lived right by the Thames. You know, where I grew up in Kent was right by the estuary, by Medway and the beach. I think there's something very warm about Brighton and Sussex. There's something really welcoming about it. And I'm not sure if that's because it's, you know, a town that's always transient, so therefore has to be welcoming, you know, students and tourists. But yeah, I love it. I really love it. I never want to leave these lovely rolling hills and the sea. Never, 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 never.
Good, don't. You can stay and just write more lovely books for us to read. Heidi, that's all we have time for today. Please can you tell us how we can find and follow you on social media and grab a copy of The Sound Mirror?
Thanks so much, Anna. I'm at Heidi Pearl James on Twitter and on Instagram. The book is everywhere in all good bookshops. Obviously, you know, I don't want to tell people where not to buy from, but buying from the indies and Waterstones and the publishers themselves, if you can't get out and you're still shielding, is great. That would be lovely. What else did you ask me? There was that. And where to follow it. Yeah, that's it, isn't it?
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Anna.
Welcome to the book club, Nick Rainstrick. How are you today?
I'm good, and thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm exhausted, but that's normal.
So, Nick, tell me a bit about yourself and about the Bicycle Clip Diaries.
Well, the Bicycle Clip Diaries started out when I was helping my dad tidy his garage, and I found an envelope addressed to me in my granddad's handwriting, and there was a pair of bicycle clips in there and a guide to Japan, but there was no explanation as to why. And it just kind of set me off on a sort of journey, both literally and in terms of like thinking about things on various sensible bicycles around the world.
Can you read us that page, please, from page 4 in the book, when you find this envelope?
Sure. A brown A4 envelope catches my eye. It's addressed to me in my granddad's handwriting. He's been dead for more than a decade, so naturally I'm curious. There's no postal address, just my name in slightly wobbly capital letters. I know that I should leave it to look at it properly later, because the first and only rule of house clearance is not to get too distracted by items of interest. But everyone ignores this rule, and I open the envelope. It contains two items. The first is a tourist guide to Japan. I flick through its pages and I'm transported. It's expensively produced on thick paper and a beautiful object. There are several illustrations, intricate prints of mountains and seascapes and trees in blossom, and photographs of jewellery and stylish-looking hotels. There are flashes of art, deco styling and brilliant colours, which have been preserved in some pages with tracing paper. It's fascinating treasure, belonging to a different era. There are longer articles too, which I don't have time to read, but the writing is a mix of Japanese and English. There is a date, 1937. The second item is a pair of bicycle clips. These are the C-shaped metal things that people used to wear around their ankles to stop their trouser legs getting oily or stuck in the chain. There's no accompanying letter to explain the significance of these items, nor whether they're linked in some way. I put them back in the envelope and put the envelope onto the keep pile, trying not to get too distracted. Why bicycle clips? What's the Japan connection? And why me?
Oh, it's such an intriguing prospect, and all the more exciting because it's true. So can you tell us, Nick, can give us some anecdotes from this trip that you wrote about in your book?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's sensible bicycle. So I'm not interested in going fast. I'm not so interested in energy gel. There's nothing wrong with that kind of cycling. But what I did was kind of travel slowly in places like Tanzania. So I had I bought an old-fashioned sit-up-and-beg kind of bicycle. They call it a black mamba in some parts of East Africa, because I work a lot in Tanzania, I should say, or I used to. So, yeah, kind of pottering around slowly and kind of meeting friendly Maasai, and I went to Colombia. That was absolutely amazing because it's just such a cool place to cycle. And I ate ants with a guy that looked a bit like Einstein on a bus after basically cycling up and down just the most incredible green mountains. But I also cycle in England as well because it's kind of a family story, really. So I visit my family. I'm from the north of England, and so I kind of visited people up there, and I always find if I set up on a bicycle and go from one place to another, things happen and it's interesting.
So you actually self-published this book in the end, haven't you? How have you found the kind of challenges of doing it yourself without the support of a bigger publisher?
It's a really good learning curve. I would say it's like a kind of apprenticeship, really, in learning how things work. Because I got really nice commentary about the book, but people said it's not really commercial, which I totally, I respect that judgment, and that's something that I just kind of accepted. But I thought, well, I've written the book anyway. It's a story I wanted to tell, so I got on with it. And sometimes it's brilliant doing it that way because I get beautiful feedback, and I've had a couple of nice reviews. And for example, my postman asked me for a copy of the book, and he wanted to buy it because everyone on the street knows that I'm selling the book, right? And I gave it to him. Of course, I said, "You're a key worker, take it." And he sent me a card and a little cartoon of his dad reading my book. It was really sweet. It's like becomes much more kind of local, like without sounding too pretentious, like farmer's market-y kind of way of doing things. You get to know the readers. On the downside, there aren't many of them, and it's a challenge. Some days it's a real hustle just trying to get anyone to read it, to review it, to and to have a look at it. It can be a bit frustrating.
So you mentioned that you are from the north of England. What brought you down to Brighton, and what is it like being a writer in Brighton?
I left Middlesbrough as soon as I could, to be honest. I left for London when I was 18, and I lived in Prague and Madrid and fun places like that. And I went to university in London, and I was actually living in Bristol when I met my wife. So it's completely my wife's fault that I'm in Brighton.
What's your favourite bookshop in Brighton, Nick?
I suppose I've got to say City Books, really. I like Waterstones. I like the experience of going into Waterstones and having a look at the tables, when you're out and about and doing things. And it's,
for instance, I don't cycle. Why should I read this book?
Yeah, I think this is the big challenge for me. Like, it's not really a book about cycling, and it's aimed at the non-cyclist. It's about the human condition and grandparents and the Japanese attitude to umbrellas and funny adventures that happened along the way and all of that kind of thing. But having said that, I also am a bit of a bicycle advocate. I cycle everywhere, basically. There's one part of Tanzania where I'd previously ridden around it on a motorbike, and it was cool. And I rode around it on a slow bicycle, and it was much better because I had the chance to meet everybody and not run animals over and things like that. So, yeah.
Nick, how can we find and follow you and buy a copy of the Bicycle Clip Diaries?
Well, I don't know if I'm allowed to call Amazon evil, but it is available on Amazon as an ebook. And in terms of the paperback, the self-published paperback, which has a few typos in this first edition, which I hope is going to make it valuable, you get that from my website. If you just Google the Bicycle Clip Diaries, you get to my website, which is nickraistrick.com, nickraistrick.com. So just Google the Bicycle Clip Diaries and you can find it there. And I should add that it's free to key workers and people that work in bike shops.
Thank you very much, Nick, for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
I am delighted to be joined in the virtual Brighton Book Club studio by the lovely Sharon Duggle, who is also a colleague at Radio Reverb and is one half of the Sharon and Reuben show. Welcome, Sharon.
Hello, Anna. Hi. Thank you for inviting me, and it's really lovely to be here.
You are so welcome. Doesn't it feel like ages ago that we did the International Women's Day Women and Music and Books
We did a for those listeners who might have heard that we did a double hander. It was great. It was the first time we'd done something like that together. Yeah, it did feel like ages ago. Honestly, Anna, I think that was the last time lots and lots of people were in in a crowd, in an assembly. So, and suddenly the world changed the week after. Ooh, yeah, we kind of knew on the verge of changing at that point, but
we did. Yeah. It was in the air. So Sharon, you've got a new book coming out next month with Blue Moose, Should We Fall Behind? Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, so this is my second novel. My first novel was Handsworth Times, which came out in 2016. So yeah, Should We Fall Behind is coming out in October this year, and I'm really excited. I'm a bit nervous, like writers always are. You know, it's such a roller coaster being a writer. One minute you're very elated, and the next minute you're thinking, oh gosh, you know, what am I doing? But yeah, it is out in October as part of Blue Moose's Women Only list. They're all the books they're publishing this year are by women. And my book is kind of set in the near past. It doesn't really say the date, but in my head it's around 2017 kind of era. And it's about a group of people whose lives kind of collide, really. People who have in some way become invisible in society or kind of less valued, but something happens and their lives collide, and we kind of find out a bit more about them through their stories that are revealed throughout the book.
Can you read us some, please, Sharon?
I can, yes. I'm going to read you a short passage just from the middle of the book, actually. It's page 97. So I know quite often people will read from the beginning, but I thought I'd read a little bit from the middle because it's really five distinct characters, and it's each of their stories. Their stories are interwoven, but they're all sort of standalone characters and with lives and stories as well. But so this one of the characters is a woman called Rhea, and this is a little bit of Rhea's story. So Rhea Banu ran. As soon as she could walk, she ran. At first, she just ran around the tumble-down timber structure where she was living on the west side of Delhi. Then, when she was firmer in her footing, she ran around the small backyard, causing chickens to flap and cluck in her wake. Copper dust plumed around her wherever she went, and when sheets which had taken a whole day to wash were coated in a film of fine orange, her small legs stung from the slapping she received as a result. On her fifth birthday, she ran out of the front door and way past anywhere she'd run before. She wanted to see what was beyond the crisscross of alleyways surrounding her little shack and what lay beyond the horizon, which appeared as a thin bright blue line across the top of a ramshackle jigsaw of dwellings. She ran without losing her breath, skipping over dank gullies, skimming the cart of the tea-waller, causing his steel cups to rattle as she passed by, tripping on a lurkey from the wobbly vegetable stand, always piled high with mountains of bitter melon and okra. As she ran, she could hear her mother's voice calling for her, echoing across tin rooftops, fading away and then becoming louder as she whirled through the maze of streets. When she passed the same tethered goat on the roadside for the third time, she stopped, sat on the curb on the corner of the crossroads and waited for a sign which would lead her back home. None came, so she began to shout, quietly at first and then more and more urgently, "Mama, I'm here, Mama, I want to come home." Her voice crackled and was so inconsequential, not even the goat batted an eyelid. She began to sob. Suddenly, Satish, the boy from the house at the back of her own, was in front of her, holding out his hand. "Come, Rhea, I will lead you home."
Sharon, that is so atmospheric. I'm really, really looking forward to reading this book. Oh,
thank you, Anna.
You are quite entrenched, I would say, in Brighton's literary scene. You work for New Writing South. And for anyone listening that doesn't know who New Writing South are or what they do, could you give us a little bit of a lowdown on that and then how you're involved with them?
Yeah, so New Writing South are the writer development organisation for the southeast of England. There's a number of writing development organisations around the country, all with a remit to sort of say, do what it says on that tin, really, help writers to develop in lots of different ways. So different writers at different stages, writing in different ways. And yeah, New Writing South runs events and workshops and masterclasses and courses, short courses and longer courses for writers who, well, people who are just kind of starting out and wanting to try writing for the first time, but also emerging writers as well. You know, we do sort of masterclasses and skills workshops, professional development workshops, as well as kind of introductory stuff, and also a lot of one-to-one mentoring, writer surgeries, kind of setting writers up with mentors who can see them through a longer process as well. So yeah, there's a website, newwritingsouth.com, and check it out. Yeah, I'm one of the program managers there, so you know, responsible for thinking about the kinds of activities writers might find useful or might be interested in, and yeah, the kind of vision of the sorts of things we want to do over the next few years as well. So yeah, we're a small team, we do a lot. But get in touch.
I can vouch for that, actually. I don't know how you guys do it. Sharon, do you find it quite difficult? Because, like, being an author yourself and being someone that helps mentor authors and program for writers, do you find it quite exposing when it's time for one of your books to come out?
Well, that's an interesting question, Anna. I think it's exposing anyway, not just because I work with writers. I work, you know, I think partly working with writers as a writer has huge benefits, because I really understand those, you know, the kind of the swings we go through as writers, and I know that all writers find any kind of you know, sort of public outing of their work quite nerve-wracking. But you know, we don't write in a vacuum, you know, we write because we want readers. So you know, you have to sort of bite the bullet, and it, you know, it is hard. It is you do feel very, very exposed. And I'm a firm believer that whatever people write, you know, whether it's science fiction or literary fiction or whatever, it's coming from a place within, you know, even if it's kind of genre fiction, which it feels unrelated to a writer's own life, it's still kind of, you know, coming from somewhere within that person. So, you know, it is quite exposing. But that is part of it. And, you know, you just kind of have to accept that, unless you want to just write in your diary for yourself, which is completely a legitimate thing to do, you've got to kind of just accept the fact that you're going to feel exposed. There's going to be really difficult moments. But actually, at the end of the day, we want people to read our work. So, yeah, you have to find ways to deal with it, find strategies. I think, and a strategy for me is not to compare and despair too much on social media. It always feels like somebody else is doing better, but actually, you know, just be proud of your own achievements, and yeah, just not get too sucked into that whole social media stuff, because that can be quite disheartening. And also say no to things as well, because some things make you feel so exposed and so vulnerable that actually, you know, they're really not good for your well-being. So it's just knowing what to say yes to and what to say no to. This is lovely. I'm very happy I'm saying yes to this.
I'm glad.
Radio is great because, you know, you're not visually exposed. So, yeah, it's very forgiving. I like radio, as you know.
I do, as do I. Your first book was City Reads, was a City Reads book, wasn't it? And how did that impact your career?
Well, I mean, that was a huge, huge honour to be chosen, because it's a panel of writers, of readers that choose those books for City Reads, and they chose my book in 2016. You know, it had a massive impact on my career, because, you know, it was my debut novel, and, you know, it's very, very hard to write a novel, as I'm sure you know, Anna, as I'm sure lots of people listening know. You know, it's a very, very solitary thing. And then actually you get through that process and you get published, which is just amazing. And that whole journey feels so difficult. But then you realise that actually it's difficult then to get your book into the hands of readers, you know, to get people to know about it. So what City Reads did for me was, you know, just really brought my book, took my debut book into the hands of readers, which was amazing, you know, and people, you know, were talking about it, and people who probably wouldn't have read it, you know, normally, just because they wouldn't have been aware of it or wouldn't have thought it was the sort of book that they'd be, you know, interested in, were reading it and talking about it. So that was just great. And to have that direct connection to readers, I went around a lot of book groups that were reading the book, and I did lots of events around City Reads. You know, that was all fantastic. Yeah, it was great. Whereas New Writing South does writer development, you know, the organisations like City Reads, Collected Works do reader development, which is just brilliant work, you know, and libraries as well. They work closely with libraries. So yeah, it was great to make me a bit more visible to people and to take my debut novel sort of, you know, to a wider audience.
Absolutely. We actually spoke to Bethan Roberts a few months ago, who was one of the first books, and that was a real kickstarter for her career. And actually, anyone listening to this, well, however you listen to it, but if you search for us wherever you get your podcast, you'll be able to hear an interview with Sarah Hutchins, who is the director of Collected Works and the founder of City Reads. Sharon, thank you very much for joining us today.
Pleasure, Anna. It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me on. I know you've got some other sort of local authors on. I'll just say Heidi James's book is brilliant. And I've just got Mark Radcliffe's book, Through the Post, which is I'm really looking forward to reading as well. So
Sharon, how can we find and follow you? And how can we get a copy of the book?
Okay, so the book is coming out on the, I think it's the 20th of October. You can pre-order it. I think you can pre-order from any independent bookshop or bigger bookshop or online massive bookshop, whatever you prefer. Or you can, you know, get it direct from the publishers, bluemoosebooks.com. And you can follow me. I've got a website, SharonDougall.com, DUGGAL.com. You can also follow me on Twitter and Facebook and those places, you know, if you want to just kind of hear a bit more about what I'm doing. But yeah, please pre-order the book and follow me and...
Mark Radcliffe, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. I'm really excited to have you here to tell me about your new collection of short stories called Superpowers, which is out now with the Valley Press.
Hello, thank you for having me. It's really nice. Superpowers. I wrote the stories about 4 years ago and I became... Oh, let's start with misery. I wrote them because I lost my mother. She died. And she raised me on her own. So I was quite close to her. And I was very interested in the things that people celebrate or notice about old people. And she didn't have, she hadn't won any awards. She hadn't made any films. She hadn't had a career. She hadn't done the things that people sort of note. But she was really quite remarkable. She was a classic old-fashioned working class single mother who raised me on a council estate with no money. And she did it with a sort of a grace and a beauty that I thought was quite remarkable and always struck me as being the things to aspire to: decency, kindness, generosity, love, all of those sort of soft, old-fashioned things. And I became really interested in how none of those qualities are noticed. So, I wrote some stories about them, really. I wrote some stories about people who manifest qualities like that and came up with these.
Do you want to maybe give us a bit of an insight into the inspiration behind The Voice Collector before you read us the opening?
Okay, yes. I've spent a lot of time working in they call it mental health now. It's mental ill health. If it was mental health, people wouldn't need to do any work in it. In the industry of psychiatry, in the industry of psychology, I spent 30 years working in that, and I left it feeling that we didn't always do very much good. And I liked the idea of simple things helping, and I liked the idea of someone just having the magic ability to remove distress, and became and began to riff on it. So came up with the voice collector. Shall I read a little bit?
Yes, please.
In the beginning, God said, let everyone have at least two voices in their head, and let the voices talk out loud so that the owner of that head can hear what they say very clearly. Let the voices not ever be full of wrath, or even a little bit sarcastic. In fact, and God said, let the voices be gentle voices, helpful and encouraging, and no jokes, or at least not many. Nobody wants a comedian in their head, not really, not all of the time. And everyone did have at least two voices in the beginning, and they were helpful and encouraging, but then things got complicated. I don't know if the problems that God stopped watching, or perhaps became distracted. Maybe she went and started another world somewhere else, or simply looked the other way. But the voices stopped being kind, and they did catch wrath, and worse, some of them became quite spiteful. Here's my theory. Do you want my theory? I'm going to put it out there while I can, because sometimes I can come and go depending on whatever it is I need to attend to. I can be saying something, concentrating and everything, and then bang, I'm sort of called away. I've collected a lot of voices and put them in my head, and sometimes one or two of them shout, and sometimes that distracts me. Anyway, my theory, for what it's worth, is that God has more than one project on the go. We, by we, I don't mean the voices in me, I mean people, loads of us all over the world, who talk a lot about there being the one God, but not so much about her having more than one universe to decorate. We could be just one of the projects she has on the go, couldn't we? Hell, we might have just been a prototype or something.
I love the opening of that story so much. These stories, Mark, are so inventive and fun, and have this kind of beautiful otherworldly, but also quite very familiar feel to them. Who are your main writing inspirations?
Oh, for these?
Yeah.
In terms of short stories, mm-hmm. like everybody else in the world, Alice Turner and Raymond Carver, I adore and admire, but I don't aspire to. They're in a different league. I think for these stories, I was really taken with some of Alexis Sayle's short stories. He wrote a book years ago called Barcelona Plates, and they were about very, very ordinary people. And we don't really know how to talk about ordinary people in extraordinary ways without becoming cliched. And I'm really interested in how we do that, because these are all very ordinary people, yet extraordinary. And he imports the absurd into the way he does that. So I was quite taken with that, I think, in terms of short stories.
So, Mark, you're a writer in Brighton. What does it mean to you to be a writer here? And, you know, why would you tell someone to come and be a writer in Brighton, or would you not?
I don't know. I think Brighton's beautiful. I think we have the benefit of the sea, and the sea makes everything better. I think it cleans the air, and I think it gives us escape. And I think that we're the best, I would say this, wouldn't I, because I live here, but I think we're the best coastal city in the country. I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. In terms of writing, there's a nice vibrancy. I think there's a sense of community. I don't think all the writers in Brighton live in a big house like the monkeys used to and sort of hang out. But I know a lot of writers here, and there's a nice sense of support and community. People try to help others, I think. I think there's other creative activity here that helps. So there's a nice vibrancy. There's a nice energy, I think. And there's sort of a generational mix, isn't there? There's a lot of youthful creativity that we benefit from and learn from and surf on. And I also think there's some older people around and some really beautiful things. So, yeah, it's got a bit of everything, I think.
Yeah, I agree. What are you working on next? Is it going to be a novel? Is it going to be short stories?
I've just finished the novel, which my agent considers to be far and away the best thing I've ever done, which is really reassuring, because she doesn't always say nice things. and I agree, I think it's really good. So I'm editing that. That's called The Three Gifts. And that there's a story in Superpowers called Immaculate Conception. And there's a couple of things in that sort of stayed with me. So some of the characters emerged from Immaculate Conception and transformed into characters in The Three Gifts. So Superpowers helped with that. I'm working on that, and I've also got a non-fiction idea about destroying psychiatry, about writing a critical thing about the industry of distress, how many people benefit from us industrializing distress. But that's less fun, I think, than the fiction.
fun, less fun, but still fascinating. Thank you so much for joining me today, Mark. How can we find and follow you and get our hands on a copy of Superpowers?
I'm about as useful on social media as an ashtray is on a motorbike. Valley Press sell the book, as does everywhere else, but we like to go to independent bookshops, don't we?
We do, particularly
post-virus, because a lot of people are struggling. It's in all good bookshops, I think, or it's orderable. In terms of me, I don't know. I work at West Dean College. If you ever want to come do some writing courses, people, come down there. We're nice. We have biscuits. We'll offer tea.
I heard you have a really good guest lecturer called Anna Burt.
She has been known to pop in, and she's very highly thought of. So.
Thank you very much, Mark. Take care.
Thank you.
Club book this month was Rainbow Milk by Paul Mendes, which is an absolutely stunning book that I highly recommend to anyone and everyone. It tracks Jesse McCarthy as he is evicted from the Jehovah's Witnesses and moves to London. And it's a story, it's a coming of age story about sexuality, love, devotion, friendship, the difficulties of religion. And it's an amazing portrayal of London in the early 2000s. A thing that I particularly love about the book is the way that Mendes talks about music, the music of the early noughties and the importance that that had for Jesse and especially in the gay scene in London. It's also an amazing depiction early on in the book of the Windrush generation. There's a really satisfying payoff at the end. I would recommend this to absolutely everyone. The writing is beautiful, it's moving, very easy to read and highly accessible. Thank you for listening to the Brighton Book Club today on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. The show is also available as a podcast where you can get wherever you get your podcast. Just search for the Brighton Book Club. You can find and follow us at BTM Book Club on Instagram, and I'm on Twitter at Anna M. Burt, B-U-R-T-T. You can email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com. The next book club book is Lara Williams' Supper Club, which I think many of you will enjoy. I am doing a live Brighton Book Club event on October the 1st with Jen Brister, who you guys may know is a comedian in Brighton and has written a book called The Other Mother. Music today I'm going to leave you with is by Sarah Vian, whose music can be found at sarahvian, V-I-A-N, music.com. This track is called The Great Pause. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you very much to Kane Harris for this music that you can hear behind us right now. Find his music at Atom Collection on SoundCloud. Do get in touch. Next month is our first anniversary show, and we are going to do a book to film special. Looking forward to seeing you guys then. Take care.
Feeling down, she doesn't know why. She can feel it in her bones, but she doesn't quite cry. A heaviness is weighing her down in her soul. Where is the joy and the peace and the flow? Is this a delayed reaction to the pandemic? The economy's crashed and the people are sick. It hasn't touched her life in any big way, but she sees it on the TV every day. The great pause, the great awakening. The planes are grounded and industry is shaking. The great pause, the great awakening. But there is peace in what was godforsaken. Growing their hair long, learning an instrument or singing a song, reconnecting with nature and baking a cake, slowing things down in the wake. So she flees to the fields and turns to the sun, breathing in the fresh breeze. She feels at one with the earth and the rivers. There's your blue sky and hopes once again it will be all right. The great pause, they were hell-bent on profit in a polluted blur. Will the PM's near-death experience and his baby's birth awaken his resolve to build heaven on earth? Planes are grounded and industries shaking. The great pause, the great awakening. But there's peace in what was godforsaken.